All right, good evening. Welcome. So tonight we're going to explore the second half of wise mindfulness, particularly looking at the Satipatthana Sutta as a frame of reference around this topic. You know, so those who have just joined us this evening, we are going through this Eightfold Path as part of the Four Noble Truths. So it's this year-long exploration. And wise mindfulness is such a critical piece of this whole puzzle. It's ironically what we often start to learn, you know, how to be mindful. But it's actually one part of a much bigger umbrella. It's a part that kind of makes us really engage with the practice in a way that makes it concrete, that we actually see in our own experience beyond the abstract. And I like to frame wise mindfulness in terms of the path to awakening, the practice toward a liberation, to the unbinding of the heart. So it's not just an application of how to help us calm down, how to help us be more present. That's certainly a part of it, but it actually goes in a much deeper way in the context of the Four Noble Truths. In the last talk, we explored how this foundation of mindfulness, the first foundation of the body, starts to first let us ground in the body, actually know where we are in time and space. You know, take us back from the future, take us back from the past, to actually connect with this present moment, what the sensations actually are in this body. You know, what's the breath like in this moment? And then it starts to go on to this process of questioning this sense of identity, the sense of this is my body, this is where I reside. You know, so it goes through it in a particular pattern and process. So it starts to have this quality of trying to, in some ways, deconstruct this assumption of a constant, unchanging self. The sense of I, the sense of me, the sense of you, of yours, that we take as being so solid. Often in the body, we start to see that's not so solid as we actually go into the sensations. So on one hand, it starts to open up this whole practice. It starts to crack the door along these lines. But this first foundation also provides this place of stability, this place of ground. Because the body is always accessible. We can always find ourselves where we are. Because sometimes we start to look at this sense of self, we may become a little less, a little more disoriented about, you know, the things we took as being solid aren't so solid. But if we learn to connect with the body, it provides this anchor. It provides this place of reference that we can come back into. So it's an important aspect. I think that's why it's first in these foundations, to provide this grounding. Yet if we just stay with the body and the breath, as sometimes we may tend to, the practice may not mature in the way it's really meant to. Because so much of our lives is the cognitive, it's the emotional, it's in all these beliefs. And learning to bring that into the practice is so essential. Because that shows up in our relationships, it shows up in how we get triggered, how we love, how we fall out of love. You know, how do we deal with Thanksgiving and all of the family dynamics that may suddenly emerge? We thought they were long gone, and then our sister says something and we're back to being a 6-year-old. For example. You know, so that this process is the practice can really go into these worlds of the rest of our lives. But having the grounding of the body is so helpful as you go along. So four foundations. The first foundation is that of the body. Second foundation is that of Vedana or feeling tone. The third one is of mind states, and then mind, sometimes defined as mind. Mind qualities are sometimes the dharmas. Now, if you count this up, there's over 30-some practices in these last three foundations. Okay, so instead of getting into the trees, we're going to stay back more in level of the forest to see this overarching perspective that's being taught through all these aspects. often look at these very comprehensive suttas that the Buddha shared and taught from, that it's this comprehensive way of looking at all these aspects of our experience. But there's often this common way that he's suggesting looking through, looking at. And so let's talk about that tonight. But before we do that, just briefly talking about these three foundations. So the first one the second one of Vedana, often called feeling tone. Now, feeling sometimes is misleading. We think of emotion. It has nothing to do with emotion. It has to do with this quality of things being perceived as being pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. Okay, very simple, very basic. But it's often overlooked. We don't recognize that this experience has this pleasant quality, or this experience is unpleasant. The reason it's so important to be present, to be aware of that, is that becomes this springboard for movement toward or away. We use the Thanksgiving feast analogy again. You know, there's that dish that you really like. There's that sense of pleasantness to the taste of it. Right? If we just experience the pleasantness, there's no problem. But often we go into that leaning, into that wanting, right? And then we start to act from that. You know, of course, acting from what things we want, there's nothing wrong with that, except when we get confused about the lasting happiness that can be from that third piece of pumpkin pie. And then the suffering that may come from after that. Right? Same thing with aversion, that sense of not wanting. If we go back to the very core piece, there's a sense of unpleasantness, right? Sometimes it's very subtle, sometimes it's more pronounced. And learning to recognize that, to be aware of it, is very helpful. The sense of neither pleasant nor unpleasant, sometimes called neutral, we sometimes gloss over. We don't pay attention to that. We kind of go into unconsciousness around it, delusion around that. Now in this sutta, the Buddha says simply discerning what feeling tone there is, knowing if it's pleasant or unpleasant or neither of those two. Also, is it of the flesh, of the body, or is it of something else, the emotions, the mind? And that's the whole quality of this one foundation, is simply knowing what is present in that quality of Vedana. For those of you who have studied dependent origination, you realize that Vedana is such a key link in that 12-step process of creating a self, creating the sense of who I take myself to be. And we do that constantly again and again. So knowing that quality of Vedana is so helpful. Right? It also is very helpful in life, because when we feel that prick of unpleasantness, if we act from that, sometimes our actions are not so skillful. Same too with craving. Now the next foundation, the third one, is of mind. Now this sutta is so interesting because it asks us to step back from our normal way of being in the world, the normal way of evaluating and thinking about things. Because as a meditator, we think, okay, it's better to be concentrated. It's better to have a steady attention, right? And this sutta says, just know what the mind state actually is. There's no sense of, notice that it's when craving or when concentration is present and when it's not. Notice when the mind's scattered and when it's not, and then judge yourself for not being concentrated. It doesn't say pat yourself on the back when you're steady. It just says know that. So we're starting to shift from, this is part of this deconstruction of our normal way of evaluation, which is really tied with our sense of self. We look out and say, I like that. I don't like that. Meditators, we learn to like and dislike a whole new set of things. Right? Oh, I'm not supposed to be sleepy. I'm not supposed to be agitated. I'm not supposed to be angry. Right? And this sutta just says, notice what's present. That's it. Just notice it. Right? So it's pointing to this quality of mindfulness, this quality of presence, which meets every experience completely equally, right, without a preference. Now that's hard to hear because we can think of all the things in life which we do have strong preferences for, that we don't want to see violence, we don't want to see assaults, and you know, all the horrible things that are in the world. Again, mindfulness is just the seeing. From that clear seeing, then wise action emerges. Then wise action comes in based on compassion, based on wisdom. So in the sutta, there's these pairs. Notice when the mind's passionate. Notice when there's aversion, when there's delusion, when the mind's constricted, when it's scattered, when it's expansive, when it's contracted, suppressed, concentrated or not concentrated, even released or not released. You know, even that sense of deep realization, notice if the mind is like that or when it's not. There's no sense of preferencing, no sense of looking for. Because as soon as we want something to be a certain way, we've established attention with what the moment is showing. The moment can't show anything other than it is. It's just how it is, you know, as the saying goes, it is how it is. The moment has arisen, and just the tension we have with that creates this whole sea of suffering. And there's no tension with it. We meet that moment. And then from there we wisely act. Maybe alleviate suffering, we take care of something, or we just be still with it. And then finally, the fourth foundation is of mental qualities. So this is it's a pretty big list. But again, coming back to the forest level, not the trees, again, it's noticing what's present. So the hindrances, that's the first set. So often we think when we're sleepy, when our minds are agitated, our body's restless, we fill with doubt, we take that as being something wrong. Something's not working in the meditation. Something's wrong with myself or with the teaching or the technique. And this is asking us to step back and just notice that that's present. It's a very radical step back. Because so often we're caught in the midst of trying to fix, trying to overcome, trying to get more of the good stuff, less of the bad. So noticing if the hindrance is present or not, if it's arising or fading. Then it goes on to the five clinging aggregates. So this sutta has many many lists, many technical aspects. And I don't want to overwhelm those who are not as familiar because it can quickly be too much to hold in one setting, one talk. But the aggregates are essentially the one mechanism that we create the sense of me, right? Dependent origination is one, aggregates is another, another one is the sense gates. So basically the way we perceive, the way we react to that, the sense of our history, our volitional actions, the physical form, quality of consciousness, these come together to create the sense of me, right? And the Buddha would say, if you take those apart, the sense of self is not located in them. The whole thing falls away. So again, this sutta looks at just notice if it's present or not. That's all. Notice if it's arising or not. Goes on to the seven factors of awakening. You know, when you hear that, the awakening is like, okay, that's the good stuff. I need to make sure I have more of that, right? And the Buddha says, no, just notice if it's present or not, period. Again, it keeps throwing you back into this sense of a bare attention, an attention that's free of our normal preferencing, wanting, disliking, which is really the language, the mechanism of that self. And the Four Noble Truths, you know, noticing the Four Noble Truths as they're arising and passing on. If you look at the sutta, this is an aside, the Four Noble Truths were probably added on later. You know, the sutta, this isn't, my sense is this is not what the Buddha actually said. It's probably a combination. He said this piece here and then this piece here. And then the people put that together as a comprehensive unit. And some of these were maybe added on. And some of the early, the research on early teachings bear that out. Maybe just the hindrances, the seven factors, are more original or older. But still, it's an important teaching to hold. So looking at these, again, the force view of these last foundations, the main thing that keeps coming through is this quality of just noticing, just seeing what's present without moving toward or away from it, without judging it. And it's so important to start to bring in these qualities of our reactivity, of our mind states. Again, if you stay just in the body and just in the breath, I use that to escape from the pain of my relationships, to escape from the pain, the difficulty I experience in life. It has a certain benefit, but it also has a limitation. It's like I have to escape to be able to meditate. Now, if we can start to turn toward that very difficulty of life, the things that get charged, the mind content, then that starts to really bring a whole other element of the practice to life. It's also much harder to stay mindful of your body, of your breath, going through having a job, having a family. Those of you who have been on retreat have probably tried that. You come off retreat, I'm going to try to be mindful. I remember after one retreat, I was feeling really quiet and still, and I was getting some gas, and I was, walking what I felt was a normal pace, and someone just honked the horn at me because they wanted me to hurry up. Got to speed up, It's like, you don't want to be on the freeway driving 35 and feeling the contact on this asphalt, and you have to speed up a little bit. So it's harder to have that really continuous, sustained attention in the body in daily life. But we do notice when we get emotional. We don't notice when we notice when we get upset, when we get excited, happy, fearful, angry. Those catch our attention, right? And if you can learn when that arises, not as something to struggle with, but actually, this is practice too. I mean, this is clearly established in this sutta, that those are also realms of practice. So our emotional life is constantly catching our attention. So that becomes the object of practice. Actually becomes a gateway into the Dharma. This is one of the key ways that daily life becomes a spiritual practice. Not as as something that we do in between our retreats and between our normal practice periods. But again, beginning with the body is so helpful because we start to develop this sensitivity to sensation. Right? I know sometimes the body, when we start to practice, the body holds a level of trauma, a level of unease that just has built up. We start to pay attention and there's like we're opening to this unfelt quality. So learning to navigate that skillfully is very helpful. But once we learn to navigate that and find a refuge in the body, then that sensitivity grows and grows. And we can start to feel that dissonance in our body when an emotion arises. Okay, where is this anger felt in the body? Where is this fear, this irritation? Feeling those echoes, the ripples of emotions, of interactions. I mean, often the body is going to register an emotion before we even do mentally. And have you ever noticed that? You're like, I just feel upset about something. My body feels tight about something. Oh, I didn't like that remark. I didn't like that interaction. I didn't like that choice I did. So feeling the body starts to ground us. It starts to allow us to orient. But also starts to unhook the personal nature of it. In the beginning class, introduction class, that point where we introduce emotions as body sensations is such a critical piece. Because usually when we're emotional, that's when we feel the most like me. I'm really angry. I'm really happy. I'm really joyful. I'm really scared. I'm really sad. It's like we feel so much. This is so personal. And when there's all the content, all the story, which all, parts of it may be very true, very real, You know, parts of it are elaborations. But coming into the body experience of it, it's like it's harder to hold the personal nature as much. When you feel like it's this pressure in the chest or this warmth in the belly, it starts to take us from this personal to the impersonal. It becomes this gateway. And some of the research around mindfulness and some of its applications, some of the the scientists tell us that when we get, you know, get triggered, when we get emotionally charged, we lose contact with our prefrontal cortex, with our ability to have executive function, to really reason. And that's why it's hard to think clearly when you're in a test. I was talking to a yogi and she was describing when she was going through school, just that, you know, for the first few minutes of this exam, just being completely frozen, right? So that's part of this really deep hierarchy of our systems. We want, you survive by freezing than think clearly and pass the test when there's perceived danger, right? And so mindfulness, learning to connect with the body and the breath, helps to shift back into our prefrontal, to be able to actually think, to be present. Mark Twain is sometimes attributed to this quote that, "I'm an old man and have known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened." And it's such a true statement, right? There's so many things we obsess and worry about, right? But most of them never happen. You've known so many great troubles, but most of them have never happened. Now, when we're not mindful of the state of mind, we're not mindful of the fact that we're worried, that we're anxious, that becomes our reality. That becomes our world. We actually become the worry. It becomes the truth and what we're relating to and from. That's what we're acting from, is that state of mind. Now, you see, if you have this capacity to step back and say, oh, the mind is filled with worry. We're no longer lost in it. We're no longer so caught in it. We actually have a little bit of space, a little bit of distance. And once you start to discover that, you realize really the power of mindfulness, really the power of having this little bit of space, a little bit of a pause can interrupt this so painful process of being obsessed and worried. There's this story that I've told a number of times, but it's such a clean and clear example of this process of getting caught in worry and how mindfulness starts to shift us out of that. So it's a story that Sharon Salzberg shares. I was teaching with my colleague, Joseph Goldstein, this is Sharon talking, when a student came to see him in great distress. The man said he just had a terrible experience. He was meditating, felt tension in his jaw, and suddenly realized what an uptight person he is, how he can't get close to anyone, and that he's going to be alone for the rest of his life. "You mean that you felt some tension in your jaw?" Joseph said. The man continued with his projections. He said he was pretty sure he'd always be tense, he'd never change. He felt hopeless. "You mean you felt some tension in your jaw?" Joseph said. I watched the man continue barreling down this path of misery for some time, all because of a sore jaw, until finally Joseph said, "You're having a painful experience. Why are you adding a horrible self-image to it?" Okay. So this story is such a clear example, and that's why Sharon uses it, and I like to borrow that, is that we have pain and we add this whole level of worry, of anxiety on top of that. And learning to connect with the actual sensations really grounds us. Now this second part, this is like the first foundation of mindfulness. The last three start to take that same experience, and now you notice not only there's the pain, but you also notice there's aversion. There's not liking. It's unpleasant. To actually notice that. Next time you're hurting, you're suffering physically, mentally, emotionally, Just notice, just acknowledge, this is unpleasant. This is unpleasant. Right? That simple step back takes you away from trying to fix, trying to engage. Okay, let me just, this is unpleasant. That simple acknowledgement then allows the heart to come in. And then the action, you're actually more directed toward the actual pain, the actual suffering that's needed. The action is much more appropriate. You can also see that's more of a consolation, that there is worry here. There's a sense of concern, of anxiety. When we notice it as a state, that means we've shifted out of it slightly. You can even go further to say there is selfing. There is a quality of making a self that is uptight, is worried, is going to be a loner for the rest of your life in that example. So usually we really focus on the content of our mind, the content of what we're worried about, what we're anxious about, concerned about, what we're fantasizing about, dreaming about. The content is what we focus on. This is part of our training, our evolutionary training. It certainly is helpful. It's not to throw out that whole process, but just to notice what we're doing and the limitation of that. Because we focus on the content, we get so caught in that. So this practice in this sutta starts to step back and notice not the content, but notice the process. Notice the trees. Now instead of noticing the trees, notice the forest. Notice the landscape that is going through the system. Instead of getting so caught in that detail. Because the details, that's where the personal pain lies. And of course, we do have to go through that at times and figure that out. But how many hours, how many years, if you add them up, have been caught lost obsessing about some detail they really had no control over? That you just had to wait till that was in front of you, and then that's what would happen. But your mind says, oh, you know, what if this happens or that happens, and soon you have 100 different scenarios, all equally bad. So you start to see the body as this ally, feeling this as a sensation, as an experience. It starts to ground us in the body, starts to shift from the content to the process. So being mindful of these mind states, discerning that it's present, is it pleasant or unpleasant, you know, what is the actual quality, that becomes the seed or a platform, a foundation for wise action. You know, which path do I want to lead? Do I want to go down that? Like I was feeling upset about something, I forget what, and just noticing how there's this whole process of action and thinking that kind of naturally comes forth. But just stepping back and pausing and feeling, okay, I'm suffering here. There is pain here. And realizing following that natural invitation or inclination just leads to more suffering for myself, for others. And same too, if I hold it in a different way, that leads to less suffering for myself and others. Gonna see how this is wise effort coming back in. And you can start to see, if you look at it, the whole Eightfold Path is this beautifully interwoven web. That wise effort, you know, comes in as mindfulness. Wise mindfulness sees clearly. Wise view is this overall arching quality of seeing what is really leading toward suffering, what's leading toward freedom. So this sutta, we can take it even more subtly. Since I've been talking about this throughout the evening, the mindfulness knowing without preference and without abstraction, without elaboration on something. So what I mean by that is, you know, I like to use the analogy of the train going by and just hearing the sound of the train. You know, and some of us have experiences that come to bear around that. This is all elaboration, right? So you come Thanksgiving, you know, you're sitting down, and then your in-laws say that one thing that they know is going to get you riled up. Okay, that there's this whole elaboration based on that one gesture, that one experience. I have lovely in-laws, just in case they're watching. Really, the elaboration is a sense of selfing, the sense of creating a self around it. This is why the sutta, again and again, it talks about focusing on feelings of mental qualities in and of themselves. The vedana in and of itself, the mind state in and of itself, the mind qualities in and of itself. Instead of the vedana and how it relates to me personally. How my mind state, how it relates to me as a person. You know, realize the echo is outward, how your mind state relates to you as a person. So just noticing it just as a bare experience, a phenomenon of nature, almost a generic thing that's arising. It's going to be a helpful quality that to start to give a little bit of disillusionment, a sense of not quite believing in that myth of self. So this is, again, very different mode than our normal seeing and evaluating. Try looking at something and not judging it. I like it. I don't like it. Oh, that's nice. That's not nice. Wanting more or less. Comparing how that fits to you, to yourself, to someone else. So these are very radical instruction. So radical because it goes so contrary to our deep conditioning, our deep patterning of always evaluating, always judging. How does this fit into what is known? How does it not fit into what is known? How we create this whole world of self and other in all its nuances, its subtle ways, and its much bigger ways. How we look out and say, you know, you are like me, you are not like me. And how there's that sense of prejudice, of judgment, of all those isms that come through. This brings to mind the Rumi poem, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing. There is a field. I'll meet you there. And when the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. Okay, so out beyond ideas of right doing and wrongdoing, beyond the normal way that we evaluate, we want things to be a certain way. Again, we're not throwing out preferences. We're not throwing out trying to make your life more comfortable, trying to make the world a better place. This is like this moment-by-moment interface. Again, when you clear that up, there's this springboard for much more powerful action in the world. That's not tainted by our reactivity, tainted by our ignorance. So going beyond these ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field. It's like this presence, this sense of field is a good word. And meeting there, and when we really surrender and lie down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. It's too full to talk about. There's no place for thought to come in because thought creates a sense of separation. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense because there's not the self and other. There's just the unity, the interconnection. So usually, this is not our experience. Usually we're so trained to look at the particulars. You know, what do we like based on our past history, our past conditioning? How our mother always made the pie crust and how the other person doesn't do it the right way. You know, there's all this sense of evaluation that just is so deep in there. That's an added-on quality. That's something we can actually notice that we're adding to the moment's experience. Now the problem with the details is that they're always in flux. They're always changing. They never are quite perfect. If they're perfect, it's not for long. Right? They're subject to the laws of impermanence, of change, of fluctuation. And in that way, they have this inherent unsubstantiality. They can't be lastingly fulfilling because they're always fluxing, always changing. That's why we're so busy and so exhausted, because we're trying to manage It's like we're juggling 10 balls and they're always falling down. We get new ones. And this is the particulars. You know, there's a sense of self inherent with each of those that we have to constantly recreate, re-establish. So you start to practice the Dharma, and this is an important point, because we practice the Dharma and we can often have this whole new set of things to evaluate from, new things to judge. You know, I even knew I had the hindrances, but now I have this whole other thing to judge about things. I'm lost in thought, you're lost in thought. So it becomes part of the same practice. We can judge other teachers, other traditions. You know, it's painful to hear about, and in some parts of this tradition, some teachers are very saying that teacher doesn't know what they're talking about. I'm the only one who knows, you know, and there's the same pattern just gets amplified out. So the third and fourth foundations start to shift this normal mechanism, this very deep-seated mechanism, into a different way of seeing. Not judging if it's good or bad, but just simply noticing the mind that's concentrated, the mind that's not concentrated. Shifting from the details to the content. Now, in doing that, we're starting to shift into something that's outside of the content, something that's much more universal. So when we view the content, actually the content, we become the content. It creates us. What I mean by that is that when we think something, when we see something we're evaluating, we think that we're having that thought. But actually, the thought is creating us. The thought is creating us. And this is, you can see this in the dependent origination, that we start to move toward craving, toward wanting, to not wanting. We're on the cycle of becoming. We create the sense of us based on that dissonance. It's like this latent tendency that's always ready to arise. Remember in my forest firefighting days, we had this fire outside of our district office, and we put it out. We thought, okay, good job, it's out. And then 2 weeks later, the fire reemerged. You know, the winds kicked up, and there's these embers. And then we had to go back and fight it again. We called one the Gold Hill Fire, and the second one the Golden Glow Fire. And it's like these tendencies are kind of always smoldering. Right? They're always under the surface. And the right conditions arise, and poof, we have a forest fire. And have you ever noticed how quickly you can get triggered by something? You know, I feel really peaceful. That was a nice meditation. Someone cuts you off, you're like, argh. You know, it's just right there because that fire is smoldering. So wise mindfulness starts to go from this process of thought creating self, these echoes that come from reactivity, from wanting something. Those echoes come back and make a sense of me. So it starts to quiet that as we come to a close of this talk. It starts to quiet this echo of making a thought into me. Now when there's not the echo, there's not that reinforcing, I see something and I have to form a relationship to it through thought, through reactivity. When there's just the seeing, then we start to open to a vastness, an expanse that's much beyond any sense of suffering, beyond, as Rumi says, that field that the heart is so full to lay in. And you can notice this, that there's a lack of separation, a lack of distance. It starts to fall away. There can be this, sometimes it can feel a little like, well, I'm kind of on the edge of something that's much bigger than I ever thought it could be. There's this something beyond what our normal mind can hold. Starting to get a taste of the deathless into awareness itself, which is outside of change. We can maybe notice this in quiet times when we see a beauty of nature or see something that doesn't trigger us like a newborn child. We're just able to abide, simply be present without having to form an opinion, an idea, a word. And there's just us, it's just the knowing and the known. And then we come back from that state into the world. We go into the world of details, into the personal, but it's held in this much bigger context. And this fluidity starts to loosen up the prison of our suffering in a way that is once it starts opening up, the Dharma becomes so real, so alive. When you actually start to taste the falling down of those prison walls. And you realize that sometimes you need to come up with those personalness, that sense of detail, to really listen, to really engage. But it's held in a much broader context. And this is what the Four Foundations teaches us. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a few moments. And letting those words settle as they will. All right, thank you for your kind attention. And before we open up to any dialogue or questions or comments, just want to go through the practice and reflection. We used to call it the homework around this topic. So keeping the sensations in the body as an anchor. So that's the first step. Know where your body is. Feel your feet on the ground. Feel the breath. You know, maybe just 10, 20% of your awareness. That is very significant. That is enough. And start to be mindful of the states of your mind and your emotions. Just notice that, okay, this is what the state of mind is in this moment. This is what the emotion is. Just that simple act of acknowledging it means you're not lost in it. You're not caught in it. Remember that mindfulness doesn't care what is present. It simply knows. It simply observes. And so to do this, you start to practice shifting from the alluring content of thought and emotion. And it's going to be very alluring. It's like the sirens calling Ulysses to the rocks. You start to shift from the content to feeling it as a process. Even a sense of it as a generic, universal process that human beings feel. Yes, it has a personal meaning, a personal expression, but it also has this generic quality to it. So for example, releasing the details of a situation you're worried about, observing the worry as a generic, universal process. Okay, so please try this on this week. You know, try it on Thanksgiving. It's a wonderful time to notice, you know, because there's lots of things going on, family dynamics, and both good and perhaps not so fun. And we can explore this next week. So are there any questions or comments or things you'd like to explore further, kind of help flesh out, clarify the talk? Yes. Yes. So the follow-up question was around when we see something and we step back and pause, that gives space for the heart to come in. And could I elaborate on that? So it's not an automatic process. It's not a guarantee, right? Yeah, it often, when we most need to do that, when we're most charged and most identified, when we're taking it the most personally, when we're really convinced what it means about the other person, right? Those are the times it's so helpful to just pause for a second, to say, okay, where is the body right now? Yeah, where is the body is a good question. feeling the body, feeling, and then feeling where this is felt in the body. This is all part of that pause, that stepping back. And acknowledge, okay, what is present here? You know, what's a generic label I could say? Is it more on the side of rage, or the more the side of fear, or of happiness, or anticipation? Just kind of roughly, what is it? Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Just acknowledging it. You know, and so to do this, we have to kind of become a little sober to the addiction of the other, to the outside, to the or internally, the personal nature of it. We have to be willing to have a little sobriety and not be so addicted to that. It's like magnets stuck. We have to kind of pry that apart a little bit and see, oh, you know, can you get a magnet apart from it? You know how it gets really strong and then you get a fart? It, like, it's still pulled, but it's not so strong. So that's, you have to work with the pause enough there. Then that deep acknowledgement, then you say, okay, where's the pain here? Where's the suffering? Where's the tenderness? And you acknowledge that. And then that acknowledgement itself starts to allow the heart to start to come out. It's like, oh, okay, this is really hard. This is painful. Or in the other, this is painful. And then from that place, then compassion. Then it's actually a really a mysterious process of what emerges from that place. Because from the mind standpoint, we want to kind of have it all mapped out. We want to have our campaign strategy lined up so we know exactly what to do in these scenarios. Right? And, you know, it's often that doesn't match up. But going into this process of feeling as a body, feeling, acknowledging it, letting the heart resonate with the pain, then something magically often comes up of what the right action is. And it's not coming from the normal place of resistance, of reactivity, of your own hurt that's not acknowledged. It's touched into the actual touching of that pain. And so sometimes, I mean, I'm often very surprised about what comes forth. It's not something I could have rehearsed or practiced. It just comes out. And sometimes it's not perfect. And then you go through the process again. It's nice to have the luxury to kind of spread this out, to feel it. And it does get quicker the more we start to learn our natural blind spots. Because we all have those tender spots that we tend to protect, we tend to guard against. And we slowly start to go into those caves and kind of, you know, turn down the alarms and guard dogs, get them quiet. You know, we start to know that, okay, that coming from that pain, that place of pain, and then we can actually act much more quickly to connect with that. Does that help? Yeah, good. Yes. Yes.
It always, and you talk about it sort of historically, it seems like maybe a place where a lot of things got added and edited. And,
yes.
How do you kind of hold that? I mean, the other ones, I can see the application in daily life.
Mm-hmm.
That one seems more remote in terms of how you work with it as
Okay, so rephrase that for the recording. I'm mentioning the fourth foundation has the Dharma lists, you know, often called mindfulness of the Dharma, and how perhaps historically some people feel some have been added on, and some of them, as you work with it, it's harder to find the application in daily life, and how do I hold that, and how do I work with that? And I think it's, you know, on one hand, just to kind of step back and realize the tradition was oral for 300 years. And so basically, if we were a bunch of nuns and monks, we would say, okay, you focus on the first foundation, you focus on the second, you work on the third, you're lucky, and you work on the fourth, you know, the fourth one. And so you're trying to capture a lot of stuff. And you just, basically, your job was to memorize it and to chant it over and over again. So I could see, you know, let's capture this piece and this piece. But when you look at the suttas, sometimes it's like there. I like to step back and see what's the big process here. Not to get so caught in the details, but what's the big process? And the two parts in there, which I think are, I think I heard this is from Buddhist scholars say it's probably more likely to be original, was the awakening factors and the hindrances. Okay, so those two, those are actually, you can get your, roll up your sleeves and actually access. You can actually, you know the hindrances. And the awakening factors are kind of these, almost the opposing way of working with those in a dualistic way. So those ones you can actually track much more easily. And the sense of the aggregates and the sense gates, that's really pointing back to this process of selfing. You know, when you want to really notice the kind of the three ways I understand that the Buddha talked about selfing, the mechanism, this is actually probably more, but the three I'm most familiar with are the dependent origination, which isn't really in this other than pieces of it, the aggregates, and the sense gates. You know, sense gates, I hear something, and there's a sense of me hearing it, right? Versus just the hearing in itself. And so in that way, it becomes much more accessible. And the Four Noble Truths, that part is, you know, that sense of orientation, that wise view is so critical to why we practice in the first place. Why do we attend and how do we attend? You're welcome. Yes.
I'm interested in better understanding how we practice that step from practicing mindfulness, pure observation, equanimity, so not judging, we observe, to, as you mentioned, it is okay to have certain preferences in a bigger view, like
yes,
wishing for less violence and suffering
yes
in the world.
Mm. Well, I'll speak from my own experience, and not speak from the, you know, the big scriptural stuff, just because that's where I can speak from. So, so the way I often use that question, which is a very common question, and you know, it's a very valid concern, because the practice often feels like we're supposed to be really passive toward life. We're just supposed to feel things fully and not do anything with them. And the reason we emphasize that in instructions, because that's often an underdeveloped capacity. We're so quick to acting, to doing. So we have to learn to kind of hold a little bit more, to feel a little bit more, right? But once we do that, just staying at that level of feeling isn't enough. We can't live that way. We have to actually act in the world. And so then that step of going from feeling that, from that equanimity, from that sense of compassion, of that bare attention, then we say, okay, what seems to be the right course? It's like if we were going to climb Mount Rainier, we kind of have this aspiration, okay, that's where it is. We do some planning, but then each step we're present for. And periodically look up to see if we're going in the right direction. You know, but we don't have to keep, if we keep looking at the mountain the whole time, we're going to trip and fall and get hit by a car and the way up until we get up there. So it's like that moment by moment, you're meeting the moment how it is. That's the bare attention. That's the equanimity. That's this quality we've talked about. But the path that you're walking, the trajectory, that's that stepping back into that wise reflection. That's all the other skills that we know. Like, okay, what's the most effective way to make change here? You know, what do people who do this well, what do they do? Right? And in doing that, you start to have this beautiful way of clearing up the reactivity and the unconscious aversion and all this other stuff that comes in and makes things not so clear. And you have a much more effective way of being, of acting in the world. So that step, you know, it's, you know, I haven't found a sutta that really speaks to that as clearly as a here you're asking. But that's how it works in my life. It's like, you know, you plan. You have a sense of clear planning as clearly as you can. And in the process of planning, you're constantly taking this kind of you know, to borrow the phrase, moral inventory. You're constantly tracking what's going on. What am I not acknowledging? What am I hiding from myself? And in doing that, you see the whole process, right? And then you come up with the best action plan. Does that help? Sort of. Yeah. Yes, Jerry.
Well, I just was going to add to your question. For me, I think we're used to running the show from our thinking head. We only rely on that, and we tend to trust that even though it isn't always very good. And it was the magic we talked about when I am in my body and feeling the truth of what is, there's like a magical wisdom that shows up. And then I know what to do. I don't think what to do, I know what to do. And that's kind of them. I don't know how that happens, but I think that's the magic of what people.
Yes, yeah, thank you, Jerry. So the comment was around the last question, that sense of pausing and that magical arising and how that arises. And there's, when that really arises from deep place, there's also a natural alignment with that. There's a sense of really getting behind it. Like, this is my heart's calling. I really care a lot about this. And then the energy comes forth. The path starts to unfold. Maybe I don't see 10 steps, but I see the next 2 steps. And connecting with that deep arising, that helps to clarify that. You know, it helps you refresh that. But it starts with coming into the body and being willing to feel things, to be willing to not know what to do. And in that not knowing, something arises outside of our normal mechanism of thought. Great. Yes, last question. You've said that before.
Have you noticed that people are perplexed when you step back and don't respond? And I'm feeling people in my life are now perplexed by non-response and non-reactivity to what they intend to be very reactive.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you've seen this.
Yes. So the comment or question is around people being kind of perplexed by a new way of you being in the world, of being less reactive, less, you know, engaged in the normal, you know, churning of life. And there's that, like, you know, there's a perplexion from other people. Yeah, so there's sometimes they're trying to find you to meet you. And I would say that that's common, that we kind of work, but also that we're in a transitional stage. That, you know, we're learning how to, you know, we see more and more clearly that my reactivity doesn't generate very good outcomes. It causes more suffering for myself and others. And we also have this capacity to hold our own difficulties so we can be more still with it. But we're kind of in that no man's land. We're not quite, you know, and then people are like, well, where are you? So partly they're not, you know, you're not engaging in the way they're used to. And then the transition that we're going toward is learning how to rise up and meet them, but in a way that's very different. Not from your reactivity, not from your judgment, your contraction, you know, all those qualities, but you're meeting them. And so sometimes as meditators, we have to actually bring that energy forth. And, you know, say things like, wow, that sounds really hard, or, you know, just things that you just kind of feel the gap there. Does that make sense? So I think it's kind of a natural transitional phase where we've learned how to kind of sit back and be quiet, but then the life is asking us to come back in, and we're not quite sure how to come back in and honor that. And sometimes that can be very, can be a long process, sometimes it's a short process, sometimes but it's part of the integration. Yeah, it's part of the integration. Thank you. All right, thank you for those engaged questions.